thank you note from an anti-aircraft gunner stationed near Baltimore. The Coast Guard banned fishing on the west side of the island and bore down on gillnetters in the middle of the night who had set nets near restricted areas. In late January, islanders experienced a temporary fuel shortage and were made to turn their oil heaters down by order of the Civilian Defense Commission. The commission asked farmers for 10,000 sandbag sacks, gunny, feed, or flour. 150 islanders attended first aid courses offered by the Red Cross Auxiliary. Peterson's store cut back on deliveries, citing fuel and labor shortages.
"Seems like you're favoring the Japs, Art,"
an anonymous review reader wrote one day.
"You're putting them on the front page every week and writing all about their patriotism and loyalty while saying nothing about their treachery. Well, maybe it's time you pulled your head from the sand and realized there's a war on. And who are you siding with, anyway?"
In January, 15 islanders canceled their subscriptions, including the Walker Colemans of Skiff Point and the Herbert Langleys of Amity Harbor.
"The Japs are the enemy," wrote Herbert Langley. "Your newspaper is an insult to all white Americans who have pledged themselves to purge this menace from our midst. Please cancel my subscription as of this date and send refund immediately."
Arthur did so. He sent a full refund to each customer who canceled, and a personal note written in a cordial style. "One day they'll be back," he predicted. But then the Price Right store in Anacortes canceled its weekly quarter-page advertisement. Then Lottie Opsvig's apparel shop on Main Street, then Larson's Lumber Yard and the Anacortes Café.
"We won't worry about this," Arthur told his son. "We can always put out 4 pages instead of 8, if that's what we have to do."
He printed the letter from Walker Coleman, and another one like it from Ingmar Sigurdsson. Lillian Taylor, who taught English at the high school, wrote back in angry condemnation of the spirit of small-mindedness evident in the letters of Mr. Walker Coleman and Mr. Ingmar Sigurdsson to well-known islanders who quite obviously have lost their grip on their senses while in the grip of war hysteria. Arthur printed that, too. Chapter 14. 2 weeks later, on February 4th, a black Ford threaded through the Imada's fields, making for the house of Cedar Slats. Hatsue was standing at the verge of the woodshed, filling her apron with cedar kindling from a pile underneath a sheet of waxed canvas, when she noticed, this was odd, that the Ford's headlights had been blackened. She heard the car before she saw it. It came to a halt just in front of her house. 2 men emerged in suits and ties. They shut their doors gently and looked at each other. One of them straightened his coat a little. He was bigger than the other, and his sleeves were not long enough to cover even half of his shirt cuffs. Hatsue stood silently with her apron full of kindling while the men mounted the porch and knocked on the door, holding their hats in their hands. Her father answered in his sweater and sandals, his newspaper dangling from his left hand neatly and his reading glasses perched on the bridge of his nose. Her mother stood just behind him.
"Allow me to introduce myself," said the smaller of the men, producing a badge from his coat pocket. "Federal Bureau of Investigation," he announced. "Are you Hiseo Imada?"
"Yes," said Hatsue's father. "Is something wrong?"
"Not wrong, exactly," said the FBI man. "It's just that we've been asked to search this place. You understand? We're going to search. Now, if you'll just step inside, please, we'll all sit down."
"Yes. Come in," said Hatsue's father.
Hatsue dropped her apron full of kindling back onto the pile of cedar sticks. The 2 men turned to look at her. The larger one came halfway down the porch steps. Hatsue walked out of the shadow of the woodshed and into the glow of the porch light.
"You come in, too," said the smaller man.
They crowded into the living room. While Hatsue and her sisters sat on the couch, Hisao brought chairs from the kitchen for the FBI men. The larger one followed him everywhere.
"Please, sit down," offered Hisao.
"You're real polite," replied the smaller man.
Then he took an envelope from his coat pocket. He handed it over to Hisao.
It's a warrant from the U.S. District Attorney. We're going to search the premises. It's an order, see? An order?
Isao held the envelope between his fingers, but made no move to open it.
We are loyal, he said.
That was all.
I know, said the FBI man. Still, we've got to look around.
While he spoke, the larger man stood and shot his cuffs, then calmly opened Fujiko's glass case and picked up the stack of shakuhachi sheet music she kept on the bottom shelf. He picked up Fujiko's bamboo flute, turned it over twice in his hands, small hands for such a thick, cloddish man, then set it on the dining room table. There was a magazine stand beside the wood stove, and he pawed through the magazines there. He picked up Hisao's newspaper.
We've had some complaints from local citizens that certain enemy aliens on San Pedro Island have in their possession items declared illegal contraband, said the smaller man. It's our job to search the premises for these. We ask for your cooperation.
Yes, of course, said Hisao.
The larger man went into the kitchen. They could see him through the doorway, peering beneath the sink and opening the oven door.
We're going to have to search through your private effects, the small FBI man explained.
He stood and took the envelope from Hisao. He put it back in his coat pocket.
I hope you won't mind, he added.
He opened the tansu, a chest of drawers in one corner of the living room. He took out Fujiko's silk kimono with its gold brocaded sash.
That's very nice, he said, holding it to the light. From the old country, it appears. High class.
The larger man came through the living room from the pantry with Hisao's shotgun seized in one hand and four boxes of shells against his chest.
The guy's all armed, he said to his partner. There's a big old sword back there, too.
Put it all on the table, said the small man. And tag everything, Wilson. Did you bring the tags in?
They're in my pocket, Wilson answered.
The youngest of the Amada girls began to whimper, covering her face with her hands.
"Hey, little girl," said the FBI man. "I know this is kind of scary, but guess what? There's nothing to cry about, you hear me? We'll be done and out of your way soon."
The large man, Wilson, went back for his sow's sword. Then he turned his attention to the bedrooms.
"Tell you what," said the first man to his sow, "let's just sit tight until Wilson is finished. Then you and me will take a walk outside. We'll tag these things up and load them in the car. Then you can show me around your outbuildings. We have to check everything. That's the way it is.
I understand, said Hisao.
He and Fujiko were holding hands now.
Don't be nervous, said the FBI man. We'll be out of your hair in a few minutes.
He stood at the table putting tags on things. For a while he waited in silence. He tapped his foot and put his mouth to the flute.
"Wilson," he said finally, "get your paws off the underwear."
Then he chuckled and picked up Hisao's shotgun.
"We got to take this," he said apologetically. "All this stuff, you understand. They'll hold it for a while, who knows why, then they'll ship it all back to you. They'll ship it back when they're done with it. It's complicated, but that's the way it is. There's a war on, and that's the way it is."
"The flute is precious," said Hisao. "The kimono, the sheet music... You must take those things?"
"Anything like that, yeah," said the FBI man. "Any old country stuff we have to take."
Hisao was silent, his brow furrowed. Wilson came back from the bedrooms looking solemn. He carried Hatsue's scrapbook.
"Pervert," said his partner. "Come on." "Crap," said Wilson. "I was going through the drawers. You do it next time if you don't like it." "Hisao and I are going out," the small man said firmly. "You can sit here with the ladies and finish up with these tags, and be polite," he added. "I'm always polite," said Wilson.
Hisao and the small man went outside. Wilson worked on the tags. When he was done, he browsed through Hatsue's scrapbook, chewing on his bottom lip.
"Strawberry Princess," he said, looking up. "You must have been flattered by that."
Hatsue didn't answer.
"It's a good picture," added Wilson. "It looks like you. Looks just like you, in fact."
Hatsue said nothing. She wished Wilson would get his hands off her scrapbook. She was thinking of asking him, politely, to put it down, when Hisao and the other man came through the door, the FBI man carrying a crate.
"Dynamite," he said. "Look at this, Wilson."
He set the crate lightly on the table. The two men stood pawing through the dynamite, 24 sticks of it. Wilson chewed on his cheek and stared.
"You must believe me," insisted Hisao. "This is for tree stumps, for clearing land."
The smaller FBI man shook his head gravely.
"Maybe," he said, "but this is still bad. This stuff," he pointed a finger at the crate, "this is illegal contraband. You were supposed to have turned this stuff in."
They took the gun, the shells, the sword, and the dynamite, and put it all in the car trunk. Wilson came back with a duffel bag and stuffed in the scrapbook, the kimono, the sheet music, and, finally, the bamboo flute. When everything was loaded in the trunk of their car, the FBI man sat down again.
"Well," said the smaller one, "this is it." "Guess what?" he said to Hisao.
Hisao didn't answer. He sat in his sandals and sweater, blinking, holding his glasses in his hand. He waited for the FBI man to speak.
"We gotta arrest you," said Wilson. "You're going on a trip to Seattle."
He unhooked a pair of handcuffs from his belt. They were clipped on next to his gun.
"You don't need those," urged the smaller man. "This guy here is a class act, a gentleman. There's no need for any handcuffs."
He turned his attention to his sow.
"They're just going to ask you some questions, okay? We go down to Seattle, a few questions, a few answers, the whole thing is over."
The two younger girls were both crying. The youngest buried her face in her hands, and Hatsue put an arm around her. She pulled her sister's head in close and stroked her hair gently. Hisao rose from his chair.
"Please not take him," said Fujiko. "He has done no bad things. He—"
"Nobody knows about that," said Wilson. "There's nobody who can say."
"Probably in just a few days," said the other man. "These things take a little time, you see. We have to take him on down to Seattle. He's got to be scheduled in and all. Maybe a few days, maybe a week."
"A week?" said Fujiko. "But what we do? What do you—"
"Think of it as a war sacrifice," the FBI man interrupted. "Figure to yourself there's a war on, you see, and everybody's making some sacrifices. Maybe you could look at it that way."
Hisao asked if he could change out of his sandals and get his coat from the pantry. He wanted to pack a small bag, he added, if that would be acceptable.
"Both," said Wilson. "Go ahead, we're perfectly willing to accommodate."
They allowed him to kiss his wife and daughters and to say goodbye to each. "Call Robert Nishi," Hisao told them. "Tell him I am arrested." But when Fujiko called, it turned out that Robert Nishi had been arrested as well. Ronald Kobayashi, Richard Sumida, Saburo Oda, Taro Kato, Junko Kitano, Kenzi Yamamoto, John Masui, Robert Nishi, they were all in a Seattle jail now. They had all been arrested on the same night. The arrested men rode on a train with boarded windows. Prisoners had been shot at from railroad sidings. From Seattle to a work camp in Montana. Hisao wrote a letter to his family each day. The food, he said, was not very good, but they were not really being mistreated. They were digging trenches for a water system that would double the size of the camp. Hisao had gotten a job in the laundry, ironing and folding clothes. Robert Nishi worked in the camp kitchen. Hatsue's mother gathered her five daughters together, Hisao's letters in her hand. She told her daughters, once again, the story of her odyssey from Japan on board the Korea Maru. She told them about the Seattle rooms she had cleaned, the sheets on which white men had vomited blood, the toilets full of their excrement, the stench of their alcohol and sweat. She told them about the waterfront cookhouse where she'd worked chopping onions and frying potatoes for Hakujin stevedores, who looked right through her as if she weren't even there. She knew already about hardship, she said. Her life had long been difficult. She knew what it was to be alive without being alive. She knew what it was to be invisible. She wanted her daughters to know how to face this in a manner that would allow them their dignity. Hatsue sat motionless while her mother spoke, trying to guess at her meaning. She was 18 now.
and her mother's story held more weight than it had when she'd heard it earlier. She leaned forward and listened carefully. Her mother predicted that the war with Japan would force all her daughters to decide who they were and then to become more Japanese. Wasn't it true that the Hakujin didn't really want them in their country? There were rumors that all the Japanese on the coast were going to be forced to leave. There was no point in trying to conceal anything or in trying to pretend they were not Japanese. The Hakujin could see it in their faces. They were going to have to accept this. They were Japanese girls in America during a time when America was fighting a war with Japan. Did any of them want to deny it? The trick was to live here without hating yourself, because all around you was hatred. The trick was to refuse to allow your pain to prevent you from living honorably. In Japan, she said, a person learned not to complain or be distracted by suffering. To persevere was always a reflection of the state of one's inner life, one's philosophy, and one's perspective. It was best to accept old age, death, injustice, hardship. All of these were part of living. Only a foolish girl would deny this was so, thus revealing to the world her immaturity and the degree to which she lived in the world of the Hakujin instead of in the world of her own people. And her people, insisted Fujiko, were Japanese. The events of the past months had proved it so. Why else had their father been arrested? The events of the last 2 months should teach them something about the darkness in the hearts of the Hakujin and the more general darkness that was part of living. To deny that there was this dark side to life would be like pretending that the cold of winter was somehow only a temporary illusion, a way station on the way to the higher reality of long, warm, pleasant summers. But summer, it turned out, was no more real than the snow that melted in wintertime. "Well," said Fujiko, "now your father is gone, folding laundry in a camp in Montana, and we all must get by, endure. Do you understand?" she said in Japanese. "There is no choice in the matter. We will all have to endure." "They don't all hate us," Hatsue replied. "You're exaggerating, Mother. You know you are. They're not so different from us, you know. Some hate, others don't. It isn't all of them." "I know what you're saying," said Fujiko. "Not all of them hate. You're correct. But on this other matter," she still spoke in Japanese, "you don't think they are very much different? In some big way, Hatsue, different from us?" "No," said Hatsue, "I don't." "They are," said Fujiko, "and I can tell you how. The whites, you see, are tempted by their egos and have no means to resist. We Japanese, on the other hand, know our egos are nothing. We bend our egos all of the time, and that is where we differ. That is the fundamental difference, Hatsue. We bend our heads, we bow and are silent, because we understand that by ourselves alone we are nothing at all, dust in a strong wind. While the Hakujin believes his aloneness is everything, his separateness is the foundation of his existence. He seeks and grasps for his separateness, while we seek union with the greater life. You must see that these are distinct paths we are traveling, Hatsue, the Hakujin and we Japanese. These people seeking union with the greater life, argued Hatsue, are the ones who bombed Pearl Harbor. If they're so ready to bend and bow, then what are they doing attacking all over the world and taking over other countries? I don't feel I'm a part of them, said Hatsue. I'm a part of here, she added. I'm from this place. Yes, you were born here, that's so, said Fujiko. But your blood, you are still Japanese. I don't want to be, said Hatsue. I don't want anything to do with them, do you hear me? I don't want to be Japanese. Fujiko nodded at her eldest daughter. These are difficult times, she replied. Nobody knows who they are now. Everything is cloudy and unclear. Still, you should learn to say nothing that will cause you regret. You should not say what is not in your heart, or what is only in your heart for a moment. But you know this. Silence is better.
Hatsue knew immediately that her mother was right. Her mother, clearly, was serene and unruffled, and her voice carried the strength of truth. Hatsue felt silent, ashamed of herself. Who was she to say how she felt? What she felt remained a mystery. She felt a thousand things at once. She could not unravel the thread of her feelings with enough certainty to speak with any accuracy. Her mother was right. Silence was better. It was something, one thing, she knew with clarity. "I could say," her mother went on, "that living among the Hakujin has tainted you, made your soul impure, Hatsue. This lack of purity envelops you. I see it every day. You carry it with you always. It is like a mist around your soul, and it haunts your face like a shadow at moments when you do not protect it well. I see it in your eagerness to leave here and walk in the woods in the afternoon. I cannot translate all of this easily, except as the impurity that comes with living each day among the white people. I am not asking you to shun them entirely. This you should not do. You must live in this world. Of course you must. And this world is the world of the Hakujin. You must learn to live in it. You must go to school. But don't allow living among the Hakujin to become living intertwined with them. Your soul will decay. Something fundamental will rot and go sour. You are 18. You are grown now. I can't walk with you where you are going anymore. You walk alone soon, Hatsue. I hope you will carry your purity with you, always, and remember the truth of who you are. Hatsue knew then that her pretense had failed her. For 4 years now she had taken her walks and come home offering fuki tendrils, watercress, crawfish, mushrooms, huckleberries, salmonberries, blackberries, even clusters of blue elderberries for making jam, anything to conceal her purpose. She had gone to dances with other girls and stood in a corner refusing requests, while Ishmael stood among his friends. Her girlfriends had sought to concoct dates for her. She was widely encouraged to make use of her beauty and to emerge from the shell of her apparent shyness. It had even been rumored for a while, last spring, that she had a secret boyfriend who was extraordinarily handsome, somebody she visited in Anacortes, but that rumor gradually evaporated. Through all of it, Hatsue had struggled with the temptation to reveal the truth to her sisters and school friends, because the truth was a burden to carry in silence, and she felt the need, like most young girls, to speak about love with other girls. But she never did. She persisted in the pretense that her shy demeanor in the presence of boys prevented her from dating them. Now her mother seemed to know the truth, or to have some inkling of it. Her mother's black hair was bound severely into a gleaming knot pinned to the back of her head. Her hands were folded majestically in her lap. She'd set her husband's letters on the coffee table, and she was perched with great dignity on the edge of her chair, blinking calmly at her daughter. "I know who I am," said Hatsue. "I know exactly who I am," she asserted again. But they were just more words to feel uncertain about. They were just more words to regret. Silence would have been better. "You're fortunate," said Fujiko evenly in Japanese. "You speak with great assurance, oldest daughter.
the words fly from your mouth.
Hatsue found herself walking in the woods later that afternoon. It was getting on toward the end of February, a time of only bleak light. In spring, great shafts of sun would split the canopy of trees, and the litter fall of the forest would come floating down, twigs, seeds, needles, dust bark, all suspended in the hazy air. But now, in February, the woods felt black, and the trees looked sodden and smelled pungently of rot. Hatsue went inland, to where the cedars gave way to firs, hung with lichen and moss. Everything was familiar and known to her here. The dead and dying cedars, full of punky heartwood, the fallen, defeated trees as high as a house. The upturned root wads hung with vine maple, the toadstools, the ivy, the salal, the vanilla leaf, the low wet places full of devil's club. These were the woods through which she had wandered on her way home from Mrs. Shigemura's lessons, the woods where she had cultivated the kind of tranquility Mrs. Shigemura had demanded. She'd sat among sword ferns 6 feet tall, or on a shelf above a veil of trilliums, and opened her eyes to the place. As far back as she could recall the content of her days, there had always been this silent forest which retained for her its mystery. There were straight rows of trees, colonnades, growing out of the seedbed of trees that had fallen 200 years before and sunk and become the earth itself. The forest floor was a map of fallen trees that had lived 500 years before collapsing. A rise here, a dip there, a mound or mouldering hillock somewhere, the woods held the bones of trees so old no one living had ever seen them. Hatsue had counted the rings of fallen trees more than 600 years old. She had seen the deer mouse, the creeping vole, the green-hued antlers of the white-tailed deer decaying underneath a cedar. She knew where lady fern grew and phantom orchids and warted giant puffballs. Deep among the trees she lay on a fallen log and gazed far up branchless trunks. A late winter wind blew the tops around, inducing in her a momentary vertigo. She admired a Douglas fir's complicated bark, followed its grooves to the canopy of branches 200 feet above. The world was incomprehensibly intricate. And yet this forest made a simple sense in her heart that she felt nowhere else. She drew up for herself in the silence of her mind a list of the things now cluttering her heart. Her father was gone, arrested by the FBI for keeping dynamite in his shed. There was talk going around that before too long everyone with a Japanese face on San Pedro would be sent away until the war was done. She had a Hakujin boyfriend she could see only in secret, who in a few short months was sure to be drafted and sent to kill the people of her blood. And now, on top of these insoluble things, her mother had only hours before probed into the pit of her soul and discovered her deep uncertainty. Her mother seemed to know about the gulf that separated how she lived from what she was. And what was she anyway? She was of this place, and she was not of this place. And though she might desire to be an American, it was clear, as her mother said, that she had the face of America's enemy, and would always have such a face. She would never feel at home here among the Hakujin, and at the same time she loved the woods and fields of home as dearly as anyone could. She had 1 foot in her parents' home, and from there it was not far at all to the Japan they had left behind years before. She could feel how this country, far across the ocean, pulled on her and lived inside her, despite her wishes to the contrary. It was something she could not deny. And at the same time, her feet were planted on San Pedro Island, and she wanted only her own strawberry farm, the fragrance of the fields and the cedar trees, and to live simply in this place forever.
And then there was Ishmael. He was as much a part of her life as the trees. And he smelled of them, and of the clam beaches. And yet he left this hole inside of her. He was not Japanese. And they had met at such a young age. Their love had come out of thoughtlessness and impulse. She had fallen into loving him long before she knew herself, though it occurred to her now that she might never know herself, that perhaps no one ever does, that such a thing might not be possible. And she thought she understood what she had long sought to understand, that she concealed her love for Ishmael Chambers not because she was Japanese in her heart, but because she could not in truth profess to the world that what she felt for him was love at all. She felt a sickness overtake her. Her late afternoon walks had not concealed her meetings with a boy her mother had long had intuition of. Hatsue knew she had not fooled anybody. She had not fooled herself, as it turned out, either. She had never felt completely right. How could they say, she and Ishmael, that they truly loved each other? They had simply grown up together, been children together. And the proximity of it, the closeness of it, had produced in them love's illusion. And yet, on the other hand, what was love if it wasn't the instinct she felt to be on the moss inside the cedar tree with this boy she had always known? He was the boy of this place, of these woods, these beaches, the boy who smelled like this forest. If identity was geography instead of blood, if living in a place was what really mattered, then Ishmael was part of her, inside of her, as much as anything Japanese. It was, she knew, the simplest kind of love, the purest form, untainted by mind, which twisted everything, as Mrs. Shigemura, ironically, had preached. No, she told herself. She'd merely followed her instincts. And her instincts did not make the kinds of distinctions having Japanese blood demanded. She didn't know what else love could be. One hour later, inside the cedar tree, she brought this matter up with Ishmael. "We've known each other forever," she said. "I can hardly remember not knowing you. It's hard to remember the days before you. I don't even know if there were any." "My memory's like that, too," said Ishmael. "Do you remember that glass box I had? The one we took into the water?" "Of course," she said. "I remember it." "That must have been 10 years ago," said Ishmael. "Hanging on to that box, being out there in the ocean, that's what I remember." "That's what I want to talk about," said Hatsue. "A box in the ocean. What kind of a start is that? What really did we have in common? We didn't even know each other." "We knew each other. We've always known each other. We've never been strangers the way most people are when they meet and start going out." "That's another thing," said Hatsue. "We don't go out. That isn't the right word. We can't go out, Ishmael. We're trapped inside this tree." "We're going to graduate in 3 months," answered Ishmael. "I think we should move to Seattle after that. It'll be different in Seattle, you'll see. They're arresting people like me there, too, just like here, Ishmael. A white and a Japanese. I don't care if it's Seattle. We couldn't just go walking down the street together, not after Pearl Harbor. You know that. Besides, you're going to be drafted in June. That's the way it's going to be. You won't be moving to Seattle either. Let's be honest with ourselves." "Then what do we do? You tell me. What's the answer, Hatsue?" "There isn't one," she said. "I don't know, Ishmael. There isn't anything we can do." "We just have to be patient," Ishmael replied.
This war won't go on forever.
They sat in silence inside their tree. Ishmael propped up against one elbow, Hatsue with her head perched against his ribs, and her legs up against the glossy wood.
"It's nice in here," said Hatsue. "It's always nice in this place."
"I love you," answered Ishmael. "I'll always love you. I don't care what else happens, I'm always going to love you."
"I know you do," said Hatsue. "But I'm trying to be realistic about this. It isn't that simple, is what I'm saying. There are all these other things."
"They don't really matter," said Ishmael. "None of those other things make a difference. Love is the strongest thing in the world, you know. Nothing can touch it. Nothing comes close. If we love each other, we're safe from it all. Love is the biggest thing there is."
He spoke with such confidence and drama about it that Hatsue allowed herself to be convinced by him that nothing was greater than love. She wanted to believe this, and so she indulged herself and tried to be swept up in it. They began to kiss against the moss inside the tree, but the touch of it felt to her false somehow. An attempt to obliterate the truth of the world and to deceive themselves with their lips.
"I'm sorry," she said, drawing away. "Everything is complicated. I can't forget about things."
He held her in his arms and stroked her hair. They didn't speak anymore. She felt safe there, as though she were hibernating at the heart of the forest, with time suspended and the world frozen, the temporary safety of a quiet way station one must leave in the morning. They fell asleep, with their heads against the moss, until the light in the tree went from green to gray, and then it was time to go home.
"Everything is going to work out," said Ishmael. "You'll see. It'll work out."
"I don't see how," answered Hatsue.
The problem was resolved for them on March 21st, when the U.S. War Relocation Authority announced that islanders of Japanese descent had 8 days to prepare to leave. The Kobayashis, they'd planted $1,000 worth of rhubarb on 5 acres in Center Valley, negotiated an agreement with Torval Rasmussen to tend and harvest their crop. The Masuis weeded their strawberry fields and worked at staking peas in the moonlight. They wanted to leave things in good condition for Michael Burns and his ne'er-do-well brother Patrick, who would agree to take care of their farm. The Sumidas decided to sell at cut rate and close their nursery down. On Thursday and Friday, they held all-day sales and watched pruning tools, fertilizer, cedar chairs, bird baths, garden benches, paper lanterns, fountain cats, tree wrap, caddies, and bonsai trees go out the door with whoever was willing to take them. On Sunday, they put padlocks on the greenhouse doors and asked Piers Peterson to keep an eye on things. They gave Piers their flock of laying chickens as well as a pair of mallard ducks. Len Kato and Johnny Kobashigawa traveled island roads in a 3-ton haying truck, hauling loads of furniture, packing crates and appliances to the Japanese Community Center Hall. Filled to the rafters with beds, sofas, stoves, refrigerators, chests of drawers, desks, tables, and chairs, the hall was locked and boarded up at 6 p.m. on Sunday evening. 3 retired gillnetters, Gillen Crichton, Sam Goodall, and Eric Hoffman Sr., were sworn in as deputies by San Pedro's sheriff for the purpose of guarding its contents. The War Relocation Authority moved into musty offices at the old W.W. Beeson Cannery dock just outside Amity Harbor. The dock housed not only the Army Transport Command, but representatives of the Farm Security Administration and the Federal Employment Service. Kaspers Hinkle, who coached the high school baseball team, stormed into the War Relocation office on a late Thursday afternoon, everyone was just then preparing to leave, and slammed his roster on the secretary's desk. His starting catcher, second baseman, and 2 outfielders, he said, not to mention his 2 best pitchers, were going to miss the whole season.
Couldn't this matter be thought through again? None of these kids were spies.
On Saturday evening, March 28th, the Amity Harbor High School senior ball, its theme this year was Daffodil Days, went forward in the high school auditorium. An Anacortes swing band, Men About Town, played upbeat dance tunes exclusively. During an interlude, the captain of the baseball team stood in front of the microphone on the bandstand and cheerfully handed out honorary letters to the 7 team members departing Monday morning.
"We don't have much chance without you," he said. "Right now we don't even have enough guys to field a team, but any wins we do get, they're for you guys who are leaving."
Evelyn Nearing, the animal lover, she was a widow who lived without a flush toilet or electricity in a cedar cabin on Yearsley Point, took goats, pigs, dogs, and cats from a half-dozen Japanese families. The Odas leased their grocery to the Charles McPhersons and sold Charles their car and 2 pickup trucks. Arthur Chambers made arrangements with Nelson Obada to act as a special correspondent for his newspaper and to send reports to San Pedro. Arthur ran 4 articles on the imminent evacuation in his March 26th edition. Island Japanese Accept Army Mandate to Move. Japanese Ladies Praised for Last-Minute PTA Work. Evacuation Order Hits Prep Baseball 9. And a Plain Talk column called Not Enough Time, which roundly condemned the relocation authority for its pointless and merciless speed in exiling our island's Japanese Americans. The next morning at 7:30, Arthur fielded an anonymous phone call. "Jap lovers get their balls cut off," a shrill tenor voice had explained. "They get their balls stuffed down..." Arthur had hung up and gone on typing a story for the next edition of his newspaper, Faithful to Praise Christ Easter Morn. On Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, Hatsue told her mother she was going for a walk. Her last walk before leaving, she pointed out. She wanted to sit in the forest, she said, and think about matters for a while. She left as if headed toward Protection Point, then circled through the woods to the South Beach Trail and followed the path to the cedar tree. Ishmael, she found, was waiting for her there with his head propped up on his jacket. "This is it," she said to him, kneeling for a moment in the entry. "Tomorrow morning we leave."
"I've got something figured out," answered Ishmael. "When you get where you're going, you write to me. Then, when the school newspaper comes out, I'll send you a copy with a letter from me inside it and put journalism class for a return address. What do you think of that plan? You think that'll be safe?"
"I wish we didn't even need a plan," said Hatsue. "Why do we have to do this?"
"Write me at my house," said Ishmael, "but put Kenny Yamashita's name for the return address. My parents know I'm friendly with Kenny. You can write me at home with no problems."
"But what if they want to see Kenny's letter? What if they ask how he's doing?" Ishmael thought about this for a moment.
"What if they want to see Kenny's letter? What if you collect maybe 6 letters and stick them all in one envelope? One from Kenny, one from you, one from Helen, one from Tom Obata. Tell them it's a request from the school newspaper. I'll call Kenny tonight and tell him about it so it doesn't sound suspicious when you bring it up. Collect them all, stick yours in last. Send them all to me. I'll pull yours out and take the rest to school. That should work out perfectly."
"You're like me," said Hatsue. "We've both gotten good at being devious."
"I don't think it's devious," said Ishmael. "It's just what we have to do."
Hatsue undid the belt on her coat, a herringbone wraparound from the pennies in Anacortes. Underneath, she wore an austere dress with a broad-embroidered collar. On this day, she'd brushed her hair out long and tossed it to flow down the length of her back, unfettered by braids or ribbons. Ishmael pressed his nose against it.
"It smells like cedar," he said.
"So do you," said Hatsue. "It's your smell I'll miss as much as anything." They lay on the moss, not touching,
in silence. Hatsue, with her hair coiled over one shoulder now, Ishmael with his hands in his lap. The March wind came up outside the tree, and they heard it tossing the ferns together, and the suspiration of the wind joined with the sliding of the water in the little creek just below. The tree muted and softened these sounds, and Hatsue felt herself at the heart of things. This place, this tree, was safe. They began to kiss and touch each other, but the emptiness she felt pervaded it, and she found she couldn't put her thoughts away. She placed an index finger against Ishmael's lips and shut her eyes and let her hair fall back against the moss. The smell of the tree was his smell, too, and the smell of the place she was leaving the next day. And she began to understand how she would miss it. The ache of it filled her. She felt sorry for him and sorry for herself, and began to cry so quietly that it was only behind her eyes, a tautness in her throat, a tightening of her ribcage. Hatsue pressed against him, crying in this silent way, and breathed in the smell of Ishmael's throat. She buried her nose beneath his Adam's apple. Ishmael moved his hands beneath the hem of her dress, then slowly up her thighs, and over her underpants to the curves of her waist, where they stayed. He held her lightly in the curves of her waist, and after a while lower at her hips, and pulled her hard against him. She felt herself lifted, and she felt how hard he was, and she pressed back into his hardness. The length of it pushed against his trousers, and his trousers pressed against her underpants, and their smooth, wet silk pushed pleasantly. They kissed harder now, and she began to move as if to gather him in. She could feel the hard length of him and the silk of her underpants and his cotton trousers between. Then his hands left her hips and traced the line of her waist and traveled along up under her dress to the clasp on her bra. She arched off the moss to make room for his hands, and he undid the clasp without struggling and pulled the shoulder straps down onto her arms and softly kissed her earlobes. His hands traveled down her body again, coming out from the dress to hold her neck under her hair, then her shoulder blades. She let her weight rest against his hands and arched her breasts to meet him. Ishmael kissed the front of her austel dress, and then began, from just below the embroidered collar, to undo its 11 buttons. It took time. They breathed into one another, and she took his upper lip between her lips while he worked on the buttons carefully. After a while the front of her dress came open, and he pulled her bra up onto her chest and moved his tongue against her nipples. "Let's get married," he whispered. "I want to marry you, Hatsue." She was far too empty to answer this. There was no way she could speak. Her voice felt buried underneath her crying, and there was no way to bring it to the surface. So instead, she ran her fingertips along his spine and against his hips, and then with both hands she felt his hardness through the fabric of his pants and felt how, for a moment, he seemed to stop breathing altogether. She squeezed with both hands and kissed him. "Let's get married," he said again. And she understood what he meant. "I want to marry you." She made no move to stop him when he slid his hand inside her panties. Then he was peeling them down her legs, and she was still crying silently. He was kissing her, and pulling his own pants to his knees. The tip of his hardness was against her skin now, and his hands were cupped around her face. "Just say yes," he whispered. "Just tell me yes. Tell me yes. Say yes to me. Say yes, oh God, say yes." "Ishmael," she whispered. And in that moment, he pushed himself inside of her, all the way in, his hardness filling her entirely, and Hatsue knew with clarity that nothing about it was right. It came as an enormous shock to her, this knowledge, and at the same time it was something she had always known, something until now hidden. She pulled away from him. She pushed him. "No," she said. "No, Ishmael. No, Ishmael. Never." He pulled himself out, away. He was a decent boy, a kind boy, she knew that. He pulled his trousers up, buttoned them, and helped her back into her panties. Hatsue straightened her bra and clasped it again and buttoned up her dress. She put her coat on and then, sitting up, began meticulously to brush the moss from her hair. "I'm sorry," she said. "It wasn't right." "It seemed right to me," answered Ishmael. "It seemed like getting married, like being married, like you and me were married, like the only kind of wedding we could ever have." "I'm sorry," said Hatsue, picking moss from her hair. "I don't want you to be unhappy." "I am unhappy. I'm miserable. You're leaving tomorrow morning." "I'm unhappy, too," said Hatsue. "I'm sick with it. I feel worse than I've ever felt. I don't know anything anymore." He walked her home, to the edge of her fields, where they stood for a moment behind a cedar tree. It was nearly dusk, and a March stillness had seized everything, the trees, the rotting deadwood, the leafless vine maple, the stones littering the ground. "Goodbye," said Hatsue. "I'll write." "Don't go," said Ishmael. "Stay here." When she finally did leave, it was well past dusk. And she walked out of the woods and into the open, with the intention of not looking back again. But after 10 steps, she did so, despite herself. It was too hard not to turn around. It was in her to say goodbye forever and tell him she would never see him again, to explain to him that she'd chosen to part because in his arms she felt unwhole. But she didn't say it. That they had been too young, that they had not seen clearly, that they had allowed the forest and the beach to sweep them up, that all of it had been delusion all along, that she had not been who she was. Instead, unblinking, she looked at him, unable to hurt him in the way that was demanded, and in some undefined way still loving what he was, his kindness, his seriousness, the goodness in his heart. He stood there, Ishmael, looking at her desperately. And that was the way she would remember him. 12 years later, she would still see him this way, standing at the edge of the strawberry fields, beneath the cover of the silent cedars, a handsome boy, with one arm outstretched, beckoning her to come back. Chapter 15. An army truck took Fujiko and her 5 daughters to the Amity Harbor ferry dock at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, where a soldier gave them tags for their suitcases and coats. They waited among their bags in the cold, while their Hakujin neighbors stood staring at them where they were gathered on the dock between the soldiers. Fujiko saw Ilse Severinsen there, leaning against the railing with her hands clasped in front of her.
She waved at the Imatas as they passed by. Ilsa, a Seattle transplant, had for 10 years purchased strawberries from Fujiko and spoke to her as if she were a peasant whose role in life was to make island life pleasantly exotic for Ilsa's friends who visited from the city. Her kindness had always been condescending, and she had always paid a bit extra for her berries with the air of doling out charity. And so on this morning Fujiko could not meet her eyes or acknowledge her, despite the fact that Ilsa Severinsen had waved and called out her name in a friendly way. Fujiko studied the ground instead. She kept her eyes cast down. At 9 o'clock they were marched on board the Kelokan, with the white people gaping at them from the hill above, and Gordon Tanaka's daughter, she was 8 years old, fell on the dock and began to cry. Soon other people were crying, too, and from the hill came the voice of Antonio Dangaran, a Filipino man who had married Eleanor Kitano just 2 months before. "Eleanor!" he shouted, and when she looked up, he let go a bouquet of red roses, which sailed gently toward the water in the wind and landed in the waves below the dock pilings. They were taken from Anacortes on a train to a transit camp, the horse stables at the Puyallup fairgrounds. They lived in the horse stalls and slept on canvas army cots. At 9 p.m. they were confined to their stalls. At 10 p.m. they were made to turn out their lights, one bare bulb for each family. The cold in the stalls worked into their bones, and when it rained that night they moved their cots because of the leaks in the roof. The next morning, at 6 a.m., they slogged through mud to the transit camp mess hall and ate canned figs and white bread from pie tins and drank coffee out of tin cups. Through all of it, Fujiko maintained her dignity, though she'd felt herself beginning to crack while relieving herself in front of other women. The contortions of her face as she moved her bowels deeply humiliated her. She hung her head as she sat on the toilet, ashamed of the noises her body made. The roof leaked in the latrine, too. After 3 days, they boarded another train and began a languid crawl toward California. At night, the MPs, who roamed from car to car, came through telling them to pull down their window shades, and they passed the dark hours twisting in their seats and exerting themselves not to complain. The train stopped and started and jolted them toward wakefulness, and there was a constant line at the door to the toilet. Many people had lost control of their bowels altogether as a result of eating in the Puyallup transit camp, including Fujiko. Her rectum burned as she sat in her train seat. Her brain felt light and unmoored inside her skull, and a cold sweat beaded on her forehead. Fujiko did her best not to give in to her discomfort by speaking of it to her daughters. She did not want them to know that she was suffering inwardly and needed to lie down comfortably somewhere and sleep for a long time. For when she slept at all, it was with her hearing tuned to the bluebottle flies always pestering her, and to the crying of the Takami baby, who was 3 weeks old and had a fever. The wailing of this baby ate at her, and she rode with her fingers stuffed inside her ears, but this did not seem to change things. Her sympathy for the baby and for all of the Takamis began to slip as sleep evaded her, and she secretly began to wish for the baby's death, if such a thing could mean silence. And at the same time she hated herself for thinking this, and fought against it while her anger grew at the fact that the baby could not just be flung from the window so that the rest of them might have some peace. Then, long past the point when she had told herself that she could not endure another moment, the baby would stop its tortured shrieking. Fujiko would calm herself and close her eyes, retreat with enormous relief toward sleep, and then the Takami baby would once again wail and shriek inconsolably. The train stopped at a place called Mojave, in the middle of an interminable still desert. They were herded onto buses at 8:30 in the morning, and the buses took them north over dusty roads for 4 hours to a place called Manzanar.
Fujiko had imagined, shutting her eyes, that the sandstorm battering the bus was the rain of home. She dozed and awakened in time to see the barbed wire and the rows of dark barracks blurred by blowing dust. It was 12:30 by her watch. They were just in time to stand in line for lunch. They ate, standing up, from army mess kits, with their backs turned against the wind. Peanut butter, white bread, canned figs, and string beans. She could taste the dust in all of it. They were given typhoid shots that first afternoon. They stood in line for them. They waited in the dust beside their luggage and then stood in line for dinner. In the evening, the Amadas were assigned to Block 11, Barrack 4, and given a 16-by-20-foot room furnished with a bare light bulb, a small Coleman oil heater, 6 Triple C camp cots, 6 straw mattresses, and a dozen army blankets. Fujiko sat on the edge of a cot with cramps from the camp food and the typhoid shot gathering to a knot in her stomach. She sat with her coat on, holding herself, while her daughters beat flat the straw in the mattresses and lit the oil heater. Even with the heater, she shivered beneath her blankets, still fully dressed in her clothes. By midnight, she couldn't wait any longer, and, with 3 of her daughters who were feeling distressed, too, stumbled out into the darkness of the desert in the direction of the block latrine. There was, astonishingly, a long line at midnight, 50 or more women and girls in heavy coats with their backs braced against the wind. A woman up the line vomited heavily, and the smell was of the canned figs they'd all eaten. The woman apologized profusely in Japanese, and then another in the line vomited, and they were all silent again. Inside they found a film of excrement on the floor and damp, stained tissue paper everywhere. All 12 toilets, 6 back-to-back pairs, were filled up near to overflowing. Women were using these toilets anyway, squatting over them in the semi-darkness while a line of strangers watched and held their noses. Fujiko, when it was her turn, hung her head and emptied her bowels with her arms wrapped around her stomach. There was a trough to wash her hands in, but no soap. That night, dust and yellow sand blew through the knotholes in the walls and floor. By morning, their blankets were covered with it. Fujiko's pillow lay white where her head had been, but around it a layer of fine yellow grains had gathered. She felt it against her face and in her hair and on the inside of her mouth, too. It had been a cold night, and in the adjacent room a baby screamed behind a quarter-inch wall of pine board. On their second day at Manzanar, they were given a mop, a broom, and a bucket. The leader of their block, a man from Los Angeles, dressed in a dusty overcoat, who claimed to have been an attorney in his former life, but who now stood unshaven, with one shoe untied, and with his wire-rimmed glasses skewed on his face, showed them the outdoor water tap. Fujiko and her daughters cleaned out the dust and did laundry in a gallon-sized soup tin. While they were cleaning, more dust and sand blew in to settle on the newly mopped pine boards. Hatsue went out into the desert wind and returned with a few scraps of tar paper she'd found blown up against a roll of barbed wire along a firebreak. They stuffed this around the door jamb and fixed it over the knotholes with thumbtacks borrowed from the Fujitas. There was no sense in talking to anyone about things. Everyone was in the same position. Everyone wandered like ghosts beneath the guard towers with the mountains looming on either side of them. The bitter wind came down off the mountains and through the barbed wire and hurled the desert sand in their faces. The camp was only half finished. There were not enough barracks to go around. Some people, on arriving, had to build their own in order to have a place to sleep. There were crowds everywhere, thousands of people in a square mile of desert, scoured to dust by army bulldozers, and there was nowhere for a person to find solitude. The barracks all looked the same. On the second night,
At 1:30 a.m., a drunk man stood in the doorway of the Imada's room, apologizing endlessly while the dust blew in. He'd lost his way, he said. Their room had no ceiling, either, and it was possible to hear people squabbling in other barracks. There was a man who distilled his own wine 3 rooms down. He used mess hall rice and canned apricot juice. They heard him weeping late on their 3rd night while his wife threatened him. On that same night, the searchlights went on in the guard towers and swept across their single window. In the morning, it turned out that one of the guards had become convinced of an escape in progress and had alerted the tower machine gunners. On the 4th night, a young man in Barrack 17 shot his wife and then himself while they lay in bed together. Somehow he had smuggled in a gun. Shikataganai, people said. It cannot be helped. It has to be. There was nowhere to put any clothing. They lived out of their suitcases and packing crates. The floor was cold beneath their feet, and they wore their dusty shoes until bedtime. By the end of the 1st week, Fujiko had lost track of her daughter's whereabouts altogether. Everybody had begun to look alike. Dressed in surplus War Department clothing, peacoats, knit caps, canvas leggings, army earmuffs, and wool khaki pants. Only her 2 youngest ate with her. The other 3 ran with packs of young people and ate at other tables. She scolded them, and they listened politely, and then went out again. The older girls left early and came back late, their clothes and hair full of dust. The camp was an enormous promenade of young people milling and walking in the fire lanes and huddling in the lee of barracks. On her way to the wash house one morning after breakfast, Fujiko had seen her middle daughter, she was only 14, standing in a group that included 4 boys dressed nattily in Eisenhower jackets. They were, she knew, Los Angeles boys. Most people in the camp were from Los Angeles. The Los Angeles people were not very cordial, and looked down on her for some inexplicable reason. She could not get a word in with them edgewise. Fujiko fell silent about everything, collapsed in on herself. She waited for a letter from Isao to come, but a different letter came instead. When Hatsue's sister Sumiko saw the envelope with Ishmael's false return address, journalism class, San Pedro High School, she did not resist her urge to tear it open. Sumiko had been a sophomore before her exile, and although she knew the envelope was Hatsue's, this mail remained irresistible. This mail was word from home. Sumiko read the letter from Ishmael Chambers in front of the tar paper YMCA building. She read it again, savoring the more astonishing phrases, out by the camp hog pens. April 4th, 1942. My love, I still go to our cedar tree in the afternoons every day. I shut my eyes waiting. I smell your smell, and I dream of you, and I ache for you to come home. Every moment I think of you and long to hold and feel you. Missing you is killing me. It's like a part of me has gone away. I'm lonely and miserable and think of you always, and hope you will write me right away. Remember to use Kenny Yamashita's name for a return address on the envelope so my parents won't get too curious. Everything here is horrible and sad, and life is not worth living. I can only hope that you find some happiness during the time we have to be apart. Some happiness of some kind, Hatsue. Myself, I can only be miserable until you are in my arms again. I can't live without you, I know that now. After all these years that we've been together, I find you're a part of me. Without you, I have nothing. All my love forever. Ishmael. After a half hour of walking and thinking and of reading Ishmael's letter 4 more times, she took it regretfully to her mother. "Here," she said, "I feel like a creep, but I have to show this to you.
Her mother read Ishmael Chambers's letter standing in the middle of the tar-paper hut with one hand on her forehead. While she read, her lips moved rapidly, her eyes blinked severely and often. Finished, she sat down on the edge of a chair, dangled the letter in her hand for a moment, then sighed and took off her glasses. "Surely not," she said in Japanese. She set the glasses in her lap wearily, placed the letter on top of them, and pressed against her eyes with both palms. "The neighborhood boy," she said to Sumiko. "The one who taught her how to swim." "Ishmael Chambers," answered Sumiko. "You know who he is." "Your sister has made a terrible mistake," said Fujiko. "One I hope you will never make." "I never would," said Sumiko. "Anyway, it isn't a mistake I could make in a place like this, is it?" Fujiko picked up her glasses again and held them between her thumb and forefinger. "Sumi," she said, "have you told anyone? Have you shown this letter to anyone?" "No," said Sumi, "just you." "You must promise something," said Fujiko. "You must promise not to tell this to anyone. Don't tell anyone about it. There's enough gossip here without something like this. You must promise to keep your mouth closed and never tell this again. Do you understand me?" "All right, I promise," said Sumiko. "I'll tell Hatsue I found the letter."
"You don't have to take the blame."
"Okay," answered Sumiko. "Good." "Go out now," said her mother. "Go and leave me alone." The girl went out to wander aimlessly. Fujiko perched her glasses on her nose once more and began to reread the letter. It was clear to her from the words in it that her daughter had been deeply entangled with this boy for a long time, for many years. It was evident that he had touched her body, that the two of them had been sexually intimate inside a hollow tree they'd used as a trysting place in the forest. Hatsue's walks had been a ruse, just as Fujiko had suspected. Her daughter had returned with fuki tendrils in her hands and a wetness between her thighs. "Deceitful girl," thought Fujiko. She thought for a moment of her own romantic life, how she'd been wed to a man she'd never seen before and passed the first night of her life with him in a boarding house where the pages of Hakujin magazines had been substituted for wallpaper. She had refused on that first night to let her husband touch her. Hisao was unclean. His hands were rough. He had no money but a few coins. He'd spent those first hours apologizing to Fujiko and explaining in detail his financial desperation, pleading with her to work beside him and underscoring his talents and better traits. He was ambitious, hard-working, didn't gamble or drink. He had no bad habits and saved his money. But times were so hard he needed someone at his side. He could understand, he said, having to earn her love. And he was willing to prove himself to her with time if she would agree to be patient. "Don't even speak to me," she'd replied. He'd slept in a chair that first night, and Fujiko had stayed awake, pondering ways to extricate herself from this situation. She did not have enough money to buy a return ticket, and at any rate, she knew in her bones she could not return to her family in Japan. Her parents had sold her and paid a percentage to the deceitful Baishakunin who had assured them that Hisao had amassed great wealth during his years in America. She stayed awake, growing angrier about this. By dawn she had begun to feel murderous. In the morning Hisao stood at the foot of the bed and asked Fujiko if she'd slept well. "I'm not talking to you," she answered. "I'm going to write home for the money I need, and go back as soon as I can." "We'll save together," pleaded Hisao. "We'll go back together if that's what you want. What about your 12 acres of mountain land?" Fujiko said to him angrily.
The Baishakunin took me to see it. Peach trees, persimmons, weeping willows, rock gardens. None of that turns out to be true.
You're right, it isn't true, confessed Isao. I don't have money, that's correct. I'm a pauper, and I work my fingers to the bone. The Baishakunin lied to you. I'm sorry for that, but don't talk to me, please, said Fujiko. I don't want to be married to you.
It had taken her 3 months to learn how to sleep with him. When she did, she found that she had learned to love him, if love was the proper word to use. And it occurred to her then, sleeping in his arms, that love was nothing close to what she'd imagined as a girl growing up near Kure. It was less dramatic and far more practical than her girlhood had led her to believe. Fujiko had cried when her hymen broke, in part because sacrificing her virginity to Hisao's need had not been what she had hoped for. But she was married now, and he was a steady sort of man, and she grew gradually close to him. They'd been already through much hardship together, and he had never once complained. Now she stood with this letter in her hand, a letter a Hakujin boy had sent to her daughter about love inside a cedar tree, about his loneliness and misery, and how horribly he missed her, and how she should write to him with a false return address. Use Kenny Yamashita's name, he'd written. She wondered if her daughter loved this boy, or if she knew the first thing about love. It made sense to her now that Hatsue had been so silent and morose, more silent and morose than her other daughters, since the day they left San Pedro. Everybody had been unhappy, and Hatsue had used this. The general unhappiness had been convenient, but still she had sulked more than anyone. She'd been listless, and had gone about her chores with the sluggishness of someone grieving. She missed her father, she said when asked. She missed San Pedro Island. But she did not say to anyone that she missed the Hakujin boyfriend who had been her secret lover. The depth of her deceit became vivid to Fujiko, and she felt in herself a mother's rage at the weight of this betrayal. The rage mingled with the general melancholy that had been growing in her steadily since the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It was one of the rare times in Fujiko's adult life when she felt inconsolable. She reminded herself to behave with dignity, no matter what the circumstances. It was a lesson she'd forgotten in her early days in America, but with time she had rediscovered it as something worthy passed down from her grandmother in Kure. Giri was her grandmother's word for it. It could not be precisely translated into English, and it meant doing what one had to do quietly and with an entirely stoic demeanor. Fujiko sat back and cultivated in herself the spirit of quiet dignity that would be necessary in confronting Hatsue. She breathed deeply